Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is singing therapist, teacher and performer Julia Hollander to talk about her book Why We Sing, which celebrates the way song inspires and heals us from the cradle to the grave. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Hi.
Hi, thanks so much for joining us. It's the perfect day to have you on the show because I've been singing in my choir this morning.
Uh-huh, in the morning.
Yes, yes. Yes, warm-ups are very important, aren't they?
I'm an evening girl myself.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. How long have you been singing for?
Oh, I think probably my whole life, yeah.
Yeah. And it's an interesting kind of concept, isn't it? I loved the way you phrase the whole thing about singing from the cradle to the grave. Because when we're born, when we're newborns, our parents or whoever may be reading us stories, trying to get us to go to sleep at night, generally sing to us.
Yes. Yeah, it's said to be the most instinctive kind of singing, the lullaby, to calm your baby down. Probably because they heard your voice even when they were in the womb. Like we hear voices from underwater in this kind of burbly, no consonants way, but with the tones. We could hear melodic lines already when we were growing in the womb. And the listening part of the brain grows very early. So maybe from the first trimester and even we can hear some version of song, of tonal vocal production.
So yeah. It really helps the baby's development then.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the impact of music and singing throughout our lives is huge, isn't it? I mean, it's I feel like we're around singing and music every day.
I am. That's great to hear you are. What kind of choir are you singing in?
Oh, we sing a real mixture of things, a lot of kind of pop music, but could be from the 50s, the 60s, 70s, 80s, right up to a present day. So a real mixture. So it's lovely. And the harmonies, and it brings so much joy, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. The best, just the best.
So why did you decide to write this book?
It was sort of two phases. I wanted to write it for a long time, particularly around my experiences with people with dementia. So I started singing with the Alzheimer's Society about 12 years ago. They have a thing called Singing for the Brain, which isn't very structured. They just send singers in. In those days, they paid us. These days, not very much gets paid for in this country anymore. Professionals are definitely on the way out as far as musicians go in the UK. Mm. But anyhow, I was a professional singer and I was singing with people with dementia about 12 years ago. And each time I did one of these singing groups, people would pop up with fantastic voices and fantastic ability. So there was a woman who could sing the whole of Crazy, you know, Patsy Cline's Crazy.
Yeah.
Just absolutely word perfect, note perfect, such a beautiful voice, but she couldn't speak. You know, there was no verbal ability left in her. She just did this kind of strange, confused, syllabic mumbling.
And she was very distressed
all the time. Very distressed. And her husband had a really hard time looking after her.
Yeah.
So he was completely more than delighted to watch her ability just flourish in those singing groups. And she would go home much clearer headed. You know, she would know how to put her coat on. She would know how to put the kettle on when she got home. There was something in her brain that was triggered by this singing. And that happened over and over again with people. And they were generally delightful, playful, without inhibition, just the best people to sing with. And actually that age group, people who are, you know, in their 60s and 70s, so maybe 10, 20 years older than me, they have a big resource of songs because they tend to have sung in their childhood. There was lots of singing at school in the 50s and 60s. There were parlor pianos. You know, people had a piano in the front room. Your nan knew a load of music hall songs. You knew them because you even went to the music hall on a Saturday. all those things have kind of fallen away in our culture, but participatory song after the war was a big thing in the UK.
Oh, it's incredible, isn't it? That must just be so emotional for you, yeah. and certainly the family members seeing their loved ones who aren't able to speak or communicate That's much it. Suddenly singing these beautiful songs with these amazing voices. Just spectacular. Yeah.
So I got the idea. Well, basically, when I started doing that work, I would write my little stories afterwards. I'd put all my kit back in the car and I'd just sit there for 10 minutes and write a little story of what had just happened in that hour's singing session. And so I got a body of stories together. And then I started thinking, well, actually, what if I kind of tease out what these people are gaining from the song? They're gaining the same thing that I'm gaining. They gain, for example, their breathing is better. They're clearly happy. You know, they are more confident. They feel socially engaged. They feel bonded with each other. They would suddenly, again, someone who hadn't spoken for weeks would go, "Oh, I love that song," or "You've got a beautiful voice," or just something, you know, really heartfelt and connected and human. So all of those things I was learning were the reason that I sang. And then came lockdown. So I wasn't allowed to sing, except for this weird thing of singing on the doorstep and Somewhere Over the Rainbow being everywhere. And, you know, but mostly professional singers weren't allowed to sing.
Hmm.
So we were all shut away with our computers, and I had time to go on my computer and look up the research and find that people had tested for endorphin levels before and after people sing together, and they'd found that they shot up after they'd had an hour singing. They found that oxytocin was absolutely pouring out of people, this love hormone that makes us feel bonded to one another. So that's why we sing lullabies to our babies, and that's why we feel really engaged and connected when we're singing with other people.
Yeah.
And that's why maybe we have songs in armies or we have protest songs. There's a lot of bonding goes on through songs, and you can see that in these biomarkers. Yeah.
We lost so much of that, didn't we, during COVID, with all the things we weren't allowed to do. And for people who do sing, you know, not being able to get together with fellow singers in choirs, singing groups, things like that, or professional singers singing in groups and things, it made a huge impact on people and people's mental health.
Yeah, yeah. We realized how much we needed it, didn't we?
Absolutely. Yeah. So do you sing every day for fun?
That's a really good question. I do tussle with this because the book is a real celebration of that. But I can't say I do, partly because at the moment, so we've come out of COVID, right? It's taken more than a year for the gigs to start coming back. But I've got a big one coming up on Sunday, and I practice for that, but I practice in quite a formal way. You know, I go into the front room, I sit at the piano, I stand at my music stand, and I do my technical work on it. And it's quite kind of, it's joyful, but it's not that spontaneous thing you do in the shower or the car. Or with me, my favorite is sitting around the kitchen table with my kids, which I don't get to do that often because the oldest is 23, the youngest is 18. But when we do, I get it. You know, that's the informal kind of singing that I completely love. But I wouldn't say I do it as much as everyone should, I have to admit. And that's this professionalizing thing that goes on where you start, if you are a professional, you start to think, oh, it's my job and I've got to do it really well. I've got to really focus when I do it, and I'm learning notes, I'm learning repertoire. So the more informal thing isn't happening quite as much as it did during lockdown, actually.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It's a shame. And I totally get that about when it becomes a job, it has a kind of different place in your life, I guess. Yeah. But we must try and do more spontaneous singing.
Definitely. All of us. Thank you for reminding me.
And have you always enjoyed singing in a certain way, in a certain style, a particular type of music?
No, I've always enjoyed singing everything. That, I mean, really, I'm super eclectic. Because I was born into quite a musical family. My grandfather was a refugee from Austria, Czech Republic, Austria, and he came as a musicologist from that area of the world to work with the BBC on Czech music. So, you know, that part of my family was very rich in folk music from the Czech Republic and also all the art song from the 19th century and 20th century, actually, in Austria. So I grew up with that kind of song. And I also grew up in choirs that were quite formal choirs, church choirs. Church is where I sang first when I was really quite young, 6, 7, sang in choirs. And then I went to university and I sang in a chapel choir. And then after university, I sang in these professional choirs in London. So I had all that formal background, but I always sang along to pop songs. I always sang. I kind of knew, because I was at primary school in the 70s, I think this is it, I learned all these folk songs that we were singing in class. It was just part of the curriculum. There was a whole day every week where we would be doing singing and music making and dancing. So I learned music hall songs. I learned all those American songs, you know, the gospel songs, for example. She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain, those sort of things. They were just part of our primary school education.
Yeah.
And then latterly, when I, after I'd had children, and obviously children bring you loads of music, they bring you nursery rhymes and mad stuff and lullabies. And then when I started wanting to sing professionally after I'd had children, when I'd stopped the professional choral work, I realized that I knew a lot of jazz songs. And that's because as a young, in my 20s particularly, I'd listened to a lot of jazz, and I had went through a phase where I was obsessed with Ella Fitzgerald. So I've just been through these sort of listening phases and then making music phases. So that was a good 10 years of singing with a jazz band.
Yeah, yeah, fabulous. And do you like kind of challenging yourself vocally? You know, if there's a song with notes in it, be it low or high, that you know can't necessarily reach easily, do you really enjoy thinking, oh, I'm going to get that note, I'm going to practice it until I've got it? Is that a fun process? Funnily enough,
that's exactly what I was doing just before we had this call. Because this piece I'm singing on Sunday, I've done it once in a concert before, but it's by Elgar. It was written in 1899, and it's about the sea. And the final, there are 5 songs. They're with orchestra. They're fantastic, big, you know, juicy songs. And the last song ends on a top A. It's called The Swimmer, and it's about swimming in the ocean. It's wild swimming. It's a fantastic theme. But it's about also having been in love in this same environment, this same wild landscape, and wishing that the wildness of the ocean that you feel when you swim was still there in your love. And it ends on this top A, and I was practicing that quite a lot just before we came on air.
And how'd you get on?
I'm still deciding, am I going to place it on the collar or am I going to place it out the top of my head? That's what I'm tussling with.
Well, well done you. And I think it's really interesting exploring the power and the emotions of music. I mean, have you experienced when you're performing, when you're singing, if it's a particularly a beautiful song, whether it's the lyrics or even just the note, the melody that really kind of gets you emotionally? Have you been able to do it without crying, so to speak?
There's a lot of that, isn't there? I think once you start singing professionally, you learn to slightly step back from it for the sake of the music. For 2 things, actually. The sake of the music, which has got to flow through you. So you've got to be in this state of openness and calm to be able to do it. And you gradually learn, because I was very nervy when I was young, and I was a lot of adrenaline, a lot of breathing in the clavicular area, you know, up high in your lungs, which is really bad for the voice. So I tussled, I struggled with all that. But gradually, as I've got older, I've learnt to calm down when I sing. Sorry about that. So I have that. But the other thing is that you also have to let the audience have the emotions. That's your job, really. They have the emotion, you have the music. That's how it works. Except in singing groups. So again, in the dementia singing groups, I've been moved to tears a lot, very often indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I think it's easy, isn't it? If something's happened in your life, you know, some kind of trauma, and you're feeling a bit delicate emotionally, you know, any type of song or notes can really hit you. It can be very difficult, can't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting thing. I mean, we talk about, you know, the voice cracking or having a frog in your throat or whatever it is. You know, we know when we're feeling very emotional that the voice is the thing that's affected really, really extremely. At the same time, some of the things I say in the book are certain states of mind, like joyfulness, or actually sobbing, the sobbing reflex, as some singing teachers call it, that actually opens up the voice. It's really interesting how, you know, it's a certain tension, almost like when you're holding onto an emotion that you don't want to cry, that inhibits your voice. Whereas if you let the sob out, that can be a, you know, a really kind of open, beautiful vocal gesture.
Yeah. And with regards to warming up your voice, which is obviously very important, the fact that you've been singing for most of your life, as you said, have you kind of changed the way you've done that over the years as more and more techniques come through, different ways to do it? Or have you found a way that works for you and always stuck to it?
No, it's changed completely. I sing completely differently from when I was in my 20s because of the information people have now about the anatomy of the voice. All the fMRI scanning that's gone on, we're so much better informed about the musculature of our breathing apparatus, about the little vocal folds, these tiny little folds that are only as big as the two of them, these things that ripple against one another to make sound. They're only as big as our little fingernail. Tiny thing inside this cartilage box in our throats. And then the pharynx, the whole anatomy is so much more explored and known about now than it was 30 years ago.
Fascinating. Mm. And when you said you're more of an evening singer than a morning singer, is that all to do with warming up the voice and it takes a while to get going with the voice in the morning?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Well, if people want to be inspired, they should get a copy of the book. It's called Why We Sing. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Julia Hollander, who we've been chatting with today. Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure, total pleasure.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.